Blog Talk Radio.
How's it going, everybody? It is Chris Block here, The Third Man In Radio, here on blogtalkradio.com/The Third Man In, here on this Monday night, August the 29th, 2011, back after, I believe it's about a month, been about a month now, not a whole lot going on, but we are back. We'll go over the forthcoming schedule here in a little bit. Got a full bank of shows scheduled for the next month or so, and we'll be rocking then through the course of the season then. But to join us tonight to talk for the next hour or so, we got Al Samaglia, Sirius XM Radio, and also HockeyIndependent.com. How you doing, Al?
Doing fine, Chris.
Fantastic. We're going to run down the news here in a second, but all is quiet, and I assume that you're enjoying your summer. You're getting recharged for the season?
Yeah, I've taken a few weeks off since the Patrick Sharp signing, and may write a blog here in the next week or so, but for the most part, just taking it easy and kicking back a little bit, and the season will be here soon enough.
Players are starting to report to Chicago, getting in the United Center gym there, getting all their off-ice workouts. They're informal because they can't actually skate informal practices for the Blackhawks until mid-September. We're about, I was looking at it earlier today. We're about 16 days away from training camp at this point, so it's right around the corner. And of course, a few days after that will be the training camp festival that I'm sure some people listening in the Chicago area will be attending. And then just 3 days after that is the first preseason game. So we're 3 weeks away from some Blackhawk hockey and getting back into the swing of things. But since we've been gone for a month, and I know that some of this stuff people would know, but let's go over everything that's going on. You mentioned the Patrick Sharp signing. That happened right after our last show. 5 years, $29.5 million, so $5.9 million salary cap hit for Patrick Sharp. Got that done. That's not the way things used to be in Chicago Blackhawks land to get something like that done as poignant as they did, but they did. Other things going on recently, of course, everybody knows Brent Sopel's signed over in Russia and Siberia. Also joining him over there, Sergei Breland, former New Jersey Devil. And now there's rumors of Jarkko Ruutu even joining that team. So Sopel's got some Wiley veterans that may be joining him over there. Cristobal Huë, it's all set in stone. He's going to be joining Freiburg again this year to finish out the final year of his four-year contract with the Blackhawks. The loan cannot be officially executed until he passes through waivers, which can't happen until September 24th of this month, and then there'll be 2 days for the rest of the league to decide whether or not they want to pick up that contract. That's not going to happen, and then shortly thereafter, Huë will be officially loaned to Freiburg and play out the final year of his deal there. So that's the Cristobal Huë update. This just happened. Jordan Hendry, who almost 6 months to the day since his surgery, which would be today, 6 months to the day, tore his ACL back on February 28th with the Blackhawks. He's getting a tryout with the Minnesota Wild this month or in September next month. So that Blackhawks also lost another prospect. Of course, we knew that Ivan Vishnevsky, the defense of the Russian defenseman who was an RFA, chose to go back to Russia playing with the Moscow Oblast. in metropolitan Moscow. Atlant, as you would see them on the internet. He'll be playing over there with Nikolai Zhirdev. Mathis Olim, RFA, decided to go back to Europe. He's playing for the Frölunda Indians in the Swedish Elite League. But the Blackhawks also lost Igor Makarov. Now, he did have a contract. Makarov did. He had one more year left on a two-year deal. He basically decided at the last moment, if you believe everything that he's put out there, that he was all prepared to come, and he was ready to travel to the States and start preparing for the season when he got a call from SKA St. Petersburg, which is his former team, or one of his former teams in the Russian League. And he signed a three-year deal before he would officially have signed that deal. The Blackhawks and Makarov worked out a release agreement, so Makarov is off the 50-man roster, as is Swedish prospect, who came over a couple years ago and played a little bit, but never returned. Jonathan Carlson, Swedish defenseman, he's also off your 50-man. So as of right now, the Blackhawks got 44 players on their 50-man roster, so a lot of room to grow. Things to play with there, to keep in that in mind. So Igor Makarov gone, back to Russia. That happened back on August 17th. It was just made official by SKA on Friday. And they also poached a Boston Bruins defenseman prospect. If you're into the Bruins, go check that out. Chris Campoli, we might be talking about him a little bit later on. Chris Campoli, still a unrestricted free agent. Ice Hogs news, the Metro Center. They sold, finally sold those naming rights to the Bank of Montreal, Bank of Montreal / Harris Bank, and they're going to turn the Metro Center into the BMO Harris Bank Center, and that's actually going on right now. 5 years, $1.3 million naming rights, so that works out to about $260,000 a year. Considering it's Rockford, I mean, it sounds like nothing, but it's something, and it actually helps out in booking touring entertainment acts to have that kind of a name and an affiliation with somebody. So you got that. Also wanted to point out that Ice Hog season tickets, they're moving a little bit, about a little bit over 650 season tickets right now. They're about 25-30 shy of their mark of last year. And again, minor league hockey, Rockford. I know that sounds like nothing, but it's not that far off the pace from the Chicago Wolves of recent years. It's about half, but still, it's a work in progress out there. It's a big year for Rockford. They've got to continue to turn their finances around, and this deal helps them. Ben Simon, assistant coach in Rockford under Ted Dent, along with Andrew Allen, who. Andrew Allen's affiliation with the Blackhawks is that Andrew Allen would be the goaltending coach. He actually, his senior year at Vermont, he was the goaltender, which was Patrick Sharp's rookie year, but he was the goaltender under Mike Haviland and Ted Dent when they won the ECHL Kelly Cup. So that's his affiliation. Got all that. Marcus Kruger tomorrow, NHLPA named its 27 NHL rookies for this coming season, and it's Rookie Showcase. It's just an event, a media event, basically, in Toronto tomorrow. It actually started today. I don't think Kruger's going to get there till tomorrow. We'll talk about that in a second. But Marcus Kruger, the only Blackhawk there. I guess you could say they slighted your playoff hero, Ben Smith. And the reason why Kruger won't get there till tomorrow is 7 Blackhawks last week were shipped off to Switzerland to participate in two-a-days, Monday through Sunday, with Swiss Elite League team Lugano, which is now coached by Barry Smith, who, of course, is an old friend from Buffalo of Scotty Bowman. He was an assistant on the Detroit Red Wings when they were winning cups with Scotty Bowman. He took the job in Lugano after being a pro scout here in Chicago last year. Still kind of technically a European advisor, talent advisor for the Blackhawks, so he's still technically employed. But Blackhawks sent 7 players over there: Nicholas Jalmerson, John Scott, Victor Stahlberg, Dylan Olsen, Marcus Kruger, Jeremy Morin, in his first action since January of last year, and Jimmy Hayes. So I think that about covers the news. The only other thing, World Junior Evaluation Camp, this is relevant. Kevin Hayes and their evaluation camp. This is not selecting the team, but their evaluation, 2010 first-round pick, Kevin Hayes, cut. He was among the first cuts in their evaluation phase. So that's something to keep in mind. It doesn't mean that he doesn't, you know, that he can't have a great first half of this season and be reconsidered, but it's definitely a blow to his aspirations of being on that team. And lastly, in October, October 25th to be exact, Gare Joyce noted, hockey historian and book author, Gare Joyce will be coming out with an unauthorized biography on the great Bobby Hull, which should be very interesting. Wiley Books, October 25th. Al, anything out of all that strike you?
More than a mouthful of information there. I think Kruger's an interesting player. I don't think maybe I don't take his presence here immediately to be on the table like a lot of people do. I think he's going to have, unless there's an injury or John Scott finds his way to Rockford, I don't see him really on the roster to start the year. But, I mean, he was impressive in some respects. He's a smart, heady player. He just doesn't strike me to have much offense. He's more of a bottom six guy right now. I don't know if he could develop into a second-line center. That's what the doctor needs to have here. And, you know, if you could place an order for something, a second-line center, and move Bolin down to the third line and have Sharp play wing is probably what would suit. But I don't know, you know, I don't see that offensive ability in him, but he's a young player, and I'm not going to pretend to have his future etched out at all. I mean, I didn't see him enough. It looks to me like he's a very careful player, a very heady player, a very responsible player in a lot of respects, but he doesn't look, he doesn't seem to have the net presence that that even a Ben Smith does. I mean, Smith seems to find the open ice and, you know, probably has a lot less talent overall than a Kruger probably, but he seems to have a head on his shoulders, and when he gets the puck, he knows how to put it in the net. And I don't know, he's playing the wrong position, really, for him to have any inside road to getting onto the roster, Ben Smith. It would be better if he was a left wing rather than a right wing. I think it would be a bit easier, but I think that they're going to have a problem trying to keep him out of the lineup. I don't know. They pumped his tires up a lot in the convention. I was at a seminar at a session, and Paul Goodman, the strength coach, was there, and they were going over, you know, some of the work habits, the off-season regimen of training for some of the players, and Bolin was also on the panel, and Goodman pumped up, you know, really a lot of the young guys said that they were making great strides in the gym, you know, really impressive. And at the top of the list was Ben Smith. So I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see how that all shakes out. And there's a lot of players who kind of fit the same role with a lot of veterans that have come in here. You can only dress so many, and it'll be interesting to see. But for my money right now, if I had a guess and place a bet, I would say Smith has a better chance to make the team than Kruger, and I think that's probably not what most people would say.
Yeah, I mean, I would think, you know, just looking at the team and what Smith can do, that I would agree with you. I think, and we had an emailer, you know, that asked that question, basically, who was gonna, you know, who we think would make the team in it. And for me, you know, you got to kind of, you know, it's like with Nick Leddy last year. You know, the question was, why is he here? Why are they pushing him? You know, why so much so soon? And then, you come to find out that they trade Brian Campbell. And it's like, okay, well, I still don't think that they needed to bring him up before March. But, you know, it kind of makes sense, you know, in the aftermath. With Kruger, it's like, you know how much Quenneville seems to like him. You know that Bowman obviously, you know, loves the kid. So you kind of, it's like, I mean, you talk about the Hawks convention. I wasn't at the Hawks convention, but, you know, I just, there's doubt in my mind, and obviously, you know, the general populace that would care about something like this at this point, as to whether or not those guys are actually going to send Kruger down. And then, you know, Kruger didn't come over, you know, didn't come to the States, you know, to play AHL hockey. He came to play NHL hockey, so you also got to think about that. But Smith's versatility, he can play center, he can play right wing, he can play left wing too if you need him to. And I just think the thing with Smith, and I keep telling people, and I like Ben Smith. All last year when people ask me, who's coming up? Is Beach coming up? Is so-and-so coming up? Why isn't Jeff Tafe coming up? It's like, no, you got to listen. Ben Smith is the guy that they're going to bring up. and it's because of his versatility. It's because he's got that young spunk. He works so hard. He deserves that. That's one thing I'll say about Stan Bowman and the Blackhawks is I do believe that they're going to reward the guys that deserve to be rewarded, and that's what happened with Smith last year. But that said, he doesn't have great hands. If he plays, you know, if he plays in front of you at whatever level all year long, at the end of the year, you're going to look at his, shooting percentage, and you're like, you know what, that doesn't sound too bad. But then you're going to think to yourself, like, God, it really did seem like he missed a ton of prime scoring opportunities. And I think that that's what kind of player he is. He's heady. He knows where to go. He's got he drifts towards a passing lane with a stick in it. He'll get a lot of chances, but he just doesn't have the hands to play on your top two lines. Which you look at him, and this would, you know, where does he fit on that bottom six? Because that's eventually where he's going. And I think the only way he fits in your bottom six is if Frolik, probably in particular, or maybe Brian Bickle move up into your top six permanently, and that remains to be seen.
See, that's why I hesitate to comment. A lot of people want to watch a 45-second tape of a prospect or what someone has done, a highlight reel, and then try to project out. I don't feel comfortable in doing that. I know you don't follow the same as far as wanting to rate players without seeing them. I have to have a feel for them. What I saw from Ben Smith here was that he could hit the net from 15 to 20 feet away, and he was in the right spot for the puck. Now, I didn't watch him much at all, more than maybe once or twice in Rockford, never at a game. So I can't comment. You know better than I. As far as Kruger, he just didn't want to shoot. I mean, he looked to pass. He didn't seem comfortable. But that could change, too. He's a young guy. I don't think it hurts him to play in the AHL for a few months. I mean, he came over from overseas, and I don't think it would be a terrible idea to, get acclimated that way. You know, let's face it. I mean, a lot of people seem to think that this lineup is all etched in stone. I don't see it that way. I don't know. Maybe I'm missing something. I still think that there could be some shuffling. And Frolik, is he going to be a wing? You know, that makes a difference, because if he's not going to play wing, if they're going to try to use him at center, that creates a whole different lineup. Is Stahlberg actually going to be able to play top 6 minutes? I don't know. Is Andrew Burnett seems to be penciled in by a lot of people to play with Toews and Kane? I'm not sure that that'll happen. Once again, I think it's going to be interesting to see how things shake out. There's a lot of extra bodies here, too. I mean, so I think one thing for sure, last year the Hawks replaced some youth but it was winning youth, experienced youth, with whatever they could find for the league minimum and some inexperience. And in a lot of respects, they were lucky to make the playoffs. They had a good season considering. I mean, you lost a lot of experience. Now they brought in experience. They brought in players that aren't afraid to fight, even if they'll lose a fight. And they'll play with an edge. All that said, you know, the top two lines still have to shake out. And I think that Quenneville is not going to waste a lot of time. You know, you look at the schedule, everybody wants to start off fast. That's understood. I mean, but the Hawks' first month, 7 games at home, only 4 on the road. You know, now you go out into November and you turn it around. You have 4 at home, 9 on the road. You're going to have to get out of that first 20 games somehow above 500, you know, and just not treading water. And it would be best off if they started off on a good note with those home games in October and won 6 out of 7. You know, and it's not going to be easy. So we have to also realize that there's going to be a period of adjustment. You know, a good part of this roster has been turned over. So I'm just looking forward to seeing how things are going to shake out. I'm not really convinced that everything is so etched in stone. As far as I'm concerned, a guy like Andrew Burnett, he could play anywhere. He could play in the fourth line, too. You know, he should be out there on the power play, and I think he will. Stahlberg, you know, he could be a player that could play top 6 minutes or not, you know, so we'll have to see. There's a lot of question marks.
Yeah, I think with Brunetta, if Taves and Kane are going to be together, I think it's a bad idea to have Brunetta on the other side, just because the things that in the offensive zone, the things that Brunetta and Kane do best, they're kind of similar. And you know, as far as getting the working the puck physically, in a physical sense, I should say, you know, as far as being the second guy down low into a scrum and working their stick, they both have really good sticks and a good knack for trailing that play. You know, having the first Blackhawk now go in and tie up a man, you know, pin that puck up against the boards and start working it, and then you see Kane come in there. Brunette's the same way. He's going to come in there. He's going to win that battle, and then he's going to work that puck around to get it towards the front of the net. That's both what they're very, very good at. Kane's great at it, and they're both kind of similar. So what gives there? Kane's not going to the front of the net, so you're going to send 38-year-old Andrew Brunette to get his tail kicked in front of the net every single night. Yes, he's very good in front of the net, but what he does, I think people are going to expect that Brunette's going to go there and camp out, and he's never going to move. That's not what he does.
He finds space.
Yeah, so if it's Kane and Taves together, then I think you need a physical presence on that line. Will Brunette play with them? For sure he will. It's Quenneville. Everybody's going to play with everybody at some point. But is that the best thing over the long haul? I have my doubts as far as that. And, you know, I think it, you know, I mean, Bickle, do we think that he could do that? I don't know. Will Olesh be, you know, be the big surprise? I don't know. I don't even know if he's on the team opening night. So, yeah, there's a lot of questions, and to point back to the note I made in the beginning, Blackhawks are 44 men on a 50 right now. If Ray Emery makes the team and Salak bumps down to Rockford, that's 45. That gives them five spaces to play with. That's a lot of room. That's enticing for a GM. You know, so we'll see. We'll see what happens, and I do believe that there could be some more tinkering before the season. And, I mean, whatever Bowman says, if something comes up, he'll just say, well, we're always looking at improving our team, and, you know, we're always keeping our eyes out. So what he says, you can take it with a grain of salt, and we'll move forward. Before we get – I want to touch on a couple more news points. Before I forget, next week we're back on the day after Labor Day, so Tuesday, September 6th. I know people have been wondering where these guys are at, and I think I've located them. Bob and John from the Fifth Feather will be the guests next Tuesday night, September 6th, 8 o'clock here at Blog Talk Radio. And then the following Monday, September 12th, a popular guest, I should say, Mike Peck, play-by-play guy of the Rockford IceHogs. Mike wears a lot of hats out there in Rockford. He'll come back on Monday night, September 12th, to talk about the new season, and also what we really want to talk to him about is the coaching change. Bill Peters out, Ted Dent in. Ted Dent's been there for 4 years now. Mike Peck's got a lot of experience working with both Peters and Dent. We want to get Mike's perspective on the coaching change and the season ahead for the Rockford IceHogs. Speaking of the Rockford IceHogs, talked about the seven players that went to Switzerland. There was one interesting inclusion and at the same time omission from that. Jeremy Morin made a lot of sense going over there because he hasn't played since January and he could use the ice time. That made sense. John Scott makes a lot of sense because they're desperately trying to improve his level of skill, and I do believe that that's because they've told him that if he can't, I mean, John Scott's probably a proud guy who wants to improve, but I wonder if he hasn't been told that if he can't get himself up to a certain level of skating skill and keeping up with the pace that the Blackhawks set or attempt to set, that he may be a goner. So he's over there. That's just my speculation. So he's over there. Jalmerson Stahlberg over there. Marcus Kruger and Dylan Olsen. So you got a top prospect in Dylan Olsen. And then you have Jimmy Hayes. The guy that didn't go over there that's interesting is former first-round draft pick of the Blackhawks, Kyle Beach. What did that say to you, Al?
More of the same. I mean, they're trying to hit him over the head and, you know, maybe embarrass him a bit more. He wasn't included with the Black Aces, and now this is another slight. As far, you know, I'm a long way away from the situation, but that's what it appears like to me. And, I mean, sooner or later he's going to have to take the bait here and realize that they're expecting more of him. And if not, It seems to me that this is his last year. I know he's still a young guy, but he needs to show up every night. You know, we could blame it maybe that he didn't see eye to eye with the coach. I don't know if that was a problem, but, you know, I get a kick out of people thinking that this guy is going to be the first call-up when he doesn't even dress every night for Rockford. And, I mean, he's not productive, and he does a lot of dumb things down there. So unless he turns things around, I think that, you know, there's a lot of scouts always hanging around the United Center and always in Rockford, and they all are looking at the same thing, and they're trying to separate the pretenders from the guys that actually could be players. And, you know, right now he's more in the pretender category in a lot of respects than actually an NHL player. So something's going to have to come to the forefront soon. Otherwise, I think they may cut bait.
Yeah, the alarming thing about it to me, if I'm looking at it from Kyle Beach's perspective, is this was an opportunity to go over there and get a head start on training camp and work on my skills playing against, you know, wherever Kyle Beach is now out there in BC, working with the level of players that he is, you know, skating with those guys right now. It's not the level that he was going to get skating with guys that are almost ready now in Switzerland to begin their season. Switzerland's pro season begins next week. So these guys are prime. They've been there for a month now. These guys are in shape, and they're ready to compete. And those were intense practices last week in Lugano. So this would have been an opportunity for Kyle Beach to go and work on his skills. It is a slight, I agree with you, but to me it's a missed opportunity, or it's the Blackhawks saying, we're not going to give you an opportunity, this great opportunity to go over there and work on your skills at this point of the season. And to me, that's what's most alarming if you're a Kyle Beach fan or if you're Kyle Beach, is that they didn't give him or offer him that opportunity.
Well, not to cut you off, but evidently, I mean, once again, from a long way away, this is what it appears, in my opinion. They monitor all of these players closely, whether it's Patrick Kane, Kyle Beach, Rob Klinkhammer, whoever it is, they know pretty much exactly where they're at with conditioning. Maybe he didn't show enough this summer. I've never really heard his name brought up with players who really hit it hard in the gym or do anything extra. And I'm not around him to see, but, you know, if that's the case, well, maybe they didn't think that he deserved the chance. And if anyone, and another thing, I mean, no one ever calls Kyle Beach a great skater. It would seem to me this was an opportunity to maybe go over there and learn a few things from a different voice and basically, like you said, jumpstart him and get him a couple of steps ahead of everyone else. So, you know, there's a method to their madness. I think that there's reasons why. We don't know exactly why, but there has to be reasons why he wasn't included.
I want to make one note. We got to move on to Patrick Kane here, but I want to make one note about the Rockford IceHogs roster this year, and it's alarming to me the way the team is constituted right now. The 26 players that are on this roster, this IceHogs roster right now, compared to last year's core 26 players, on opening night, this team will be an average of 22.8 years old. Last year, it was 24.3 years old on average on opening night. And they're also smaller. I know that there's a thought out there that they're bigger. They're not. They're smaller. They've lost Wade Brookbank. They've lost Cullimore, who's a huge guy. Exelby, who plays pretty big. He's only 6'2", basically, but he plays big. Makarov wasn't a small guy. They've lost a lot of size. I think they're scrappier.
And toughness, too, right?
What's that?
And some toughness, too, right?
And some toughness. Kyle Hagel, Brooke, you know, I mean, they've got young, exuberant guys that are going to be willing to be feisty and go out there and compete. But when those are all young guys, it's a trick to try to channel that in a successful way. And this team is presently constituted, in my opinion, just looking at it, is going to get curb stomped. And they better do something, because this is a big year of development for all these guys. And unless Morin's going to score 100 goals, and he's not, this team's got a lot of problems right now. And we'll see what they do to – I mean, there's got to be a veteran signing out there. That's the other part of this. on average last year, or let's go total games, going into last season, there was of pro games, there was a total of 4,600 pro games under the belts of Rockford IceHogs players. Going into this year, 2,000, and that's an average of 76. The only player with any NHL experience whatsoever, aside from a cup of tea here and there, is and that would be Morin, is Brett McLean. Of their 417 NHL games, he's got 385 of them. That's not conducive to winning in the AHL. I don't care what you think. Veterans help teams win down there, and they don't have enough of them, and they don't have enough scoring, and they don't have enough toughness, and they've got to make some changes. So I would expect that they would, because we're still a month out, and there's a lot of time left, but I just want to dispel that myth that the Rockford IceHogs suddenly got enormous and tough to play against, because they didn't.
Yeah, and when you factor in the fact that they have a rookie head coach with no head coaching experience, you know, with a very young team, and if they don't use any of the spots to bring in some veteran leadership, he's going to have his hands full, and he's got to be a very good teacher. The Hawks have a lot of money, a big investment in some of these guys from the standpoint that, you know, they traded away some proven talent to get hopefully potential NHL players back, but they need some help. They need mentoring. They need to be taught. And Ted Dent, you know, he has a full plate, and I wish him well because he's got a big job ahead of him.
Last Tuesday, talking about Patrick Kane, we got an update on Patrick Kane's wrist surgery. Of course, right after the Hawks convention, he went in and doctors found a broken bone in his wrist. He went and had surgery. At the time, it was said he was 6 to 8 weeks recovery. A little skeptical of that from the beginning because it's, you know, they basically said he was going to have a cast on for 6 weeks. Well, 6 weeks is up, I believe, tomorrow. So Patrick Kane last Tuesday, August 23rd, went on the Fan 590 in Toronto. A day after Stan Bowman at the Blackhawks alumni golf outing insisted that Kane would be ready for the start of training camp. Patrick Kane went on Fan 590 at fan590.com and said this.
Well, you know, I still got a little cast on, so probably a little bit longer. Like I said, I'm not really going to rush anything. We still got a lot of time. My goal is to be ready for, you know, the opening regular season game. I mean, obviously, you'd like to be back in training camp, but no more importantly, I think the date is October 7th for our first regular season game. So that's kind of the date I'm working for. Really no rush because things are going pretty well right now.
Any of that bother you at all, Al?
It's not surprising. I think, you know, like you said, I mean, Stan Bowman gets caught sometimes with, you know, everyone weighing on every word. I mean, he's coming along okay so far, but he still has a cast on. So, I mean, you don't know. And if everything goes according to plan, it seems to me 6 weeks with a cast on, 5 weeks or so off, and then maybe you could start playing again. Does he really need to be skating in? First off, he wasn't going to play in every exhibition game. So does he really need to play more than two exhibition games? Probably not. Do you want to put him in there, you know, in the beginning of exhibition season with a lot of young guys looking to make a name for themselves? You know, he's coming off wrist surgery. I don't think so. So to me, in a perfect world, if he could play two out of the last four games, play a couple of games, have his conditioning up to snuff so that he hits the regular season, you know, on par as much as he can be with everyone else, that's good enough. You know, and let's face it, you know, not to be like Chicken Little, maybe things don't turn out that well. Maybe they take the cast off. Maybe it doesn't work out where, you know, everything's looking great, you know, and he's backed up a little bit. Whatever it is, it's his wrist. There's no hiding it. He needs his hands. And they're not going to sacrifice pushing him forward in the beginning of the year unless he's, you know, pretty much 95% or more healthy and ready to go.
Yeah, to me, when the 6 to 8 weeks came out, it just seemed too convenient to me. You know, it's like, you know, this is just, you know, a theory, a conspiracy theory, if you want to call it. 6 to 8 weeks from the date of surgery would put the Blackhawks to the 13th, which they're reporting either the 13th or the 14th to training camp. You know, so that's 8 weeks. So if he says 6 to 8 weeks, or the doctor says 6 to 8 weeks, nobody's asking questions like that were out there that, well, why didn't he have this taken care of sooner? Why is he waiting so long? Is he going to be late for camp? Is he going to miss some of the regular season? If you just say 6 to 8 weeks, it's done. And all if everything works out great, maybe he makes 6 to 8 weeks, or if not, he misses a week and a half of training camp. Listen, if he gets the cast off tomorrow, which I know is a possibility, it's going to be at least a week before he can even grip a stick. And then he's got to rehab. He's got to build the strength back up in his hand. And then you're talking about he'll be at camp. Stan Bowman didn't lie. He'll be there. He'll be training. I just don't think he's going to be participating in practices or games probably until that final week.
Right, exactly. And that takes us right to the beginning of, you know, the end of September, beginning of October seems to me, you know, that's the best case. So. You know, hopefully it's as minor as it appears it could be, and although it was a surgery. And he's ready to go when the season starts.
I wanted to talk about this, Al, because, you know, we are Chicago, and Patrick Kane is one of the biggest stars in the league. So, of course, anything he says is going to be news. But, you know, a lot of traffic was sent to the fan590.com last week because of Kane, and I think that wasn't Kane's interview wasn't even one of the more interesting ones. Dave Scatcherd, longtime NHL player, recently retired, concussions. So, you know, his career succumbed to concussions. Can't do it anymore. Doctors told him that he's risking far too much, and so he's got to hang it up. At age 35, I believe that he's done. He played in Peoria last year. He was brought up to St. Louis a bit. Is in the last week of the season in April, he got a vicious hit in Milwaukee, and you know that's it. He's done. Scatcherd went on the Fan 590, and again, these clips are fan590.com. I don't know if you could tell, I've had two cans of Monster and six cups of coffee today, Al, so if I explode, I could at any minute. he went on and talked about, this past Thursday, he went on and talked about the process, and also, this is a tremendous interview. I really implore people, if you're listening to this now, before it gets wiped off their website, because they only keep about 2-3 weeks at a time in the archive, go up there, Dave Scatcherd, from Thursday, August 25th. It's about 20 minutes long. It's a fantastic interview. I think you'll learn a lot. If you're really concerned about these players and what these guys are going through and the decisions that they have to make, I think you'll learn a lot from a guy who's willing to talk about it and has nothing to lose now. But I wanted to play a little clip. The host basically asked Dave Scatcherd if he considered ignoring the doctor's suggestions and maybe possibly doing what he had to do to continue on. And this is what Dave Scatcherd had to say.
Did you feel before getting the doctor's advice a few days ago that you were fine? Did the news come out of left field?
No. I mean, you know, I was planning on playing, and sometimes you can kind of like, I don't want to say beat the test, but I mean, like, if I want to play, I can, you know, kind of like not say everything that I'm feeling and kind of do that. But when I went to pass my physical in St. Louis, the neuro psych guy kind of saw through some of that and said, you know, you still have a lot of things going on that we're not really dealing with, and we need to figure out what's going on with you. So,
Al, we've talked in the past about, you know, players and concussions are a real thing. This isn't something, you know, that's, you know, I know that there's people that have speculated, oh, concussions have been around for years and now doctors are just being overly sensitive. No, with the equipment, with the speed of the game, with the amount of ice that these guys covered, a lot of times these guys are out there in no man's land, and the rate of these concussions is alarming, and it's continuing to grow. I know that you've talked about it in the past, but listening to that Scatcherd interview, what probably stuck out to you the most about where he's at this point in his life? Forget about his career.
It was a great interview, and to be honest with you, I felt the sadness. I mean, guy, three young kids, and you know, forget about hockey. You know, so he can't play in the AHL this year, but that's. He can make a nice living doing that, doing something that he loves. But beyond all that, I mean, there seems to be a doubt in his mind whether he'll ever be normal again. And, you know, he has trouble focusing. He has trouble doing certain tasks that we would consider everyday routine. And the part about beating the test, very candid, not a shock. You know, and I think, unfortunately, what the NHL probably is going to have to do, maybe I'm not sure if the NFL does the same, and this is not to imply a team doctor would sacrifice someone's health, but there's a familiarity there between the player and a doctor, and they kind of know how to read each other, I would think, after a while, and it's almost too convenient. It's almost like, you know, an Enron when they would have their auditor be their consultant and vice versa, and you know, the checks and balances aren't in place, and bad things can happen. I think that there probably should be a league-sanctioned committee that the players have to go in front of to get cleared, and it should be standardized. And maybe they have it regionally where you go and see one or two or three different doctors or whatever the case may be, and you go from there. There's just some suspicious stuff when you see how fast some players come back and other players don't. You know, and I still think that even though we're in such a sophisticated world now, medically, with technology and everything else, in a lot of respects, there's still so much that's really not understood about the human brain. So it's a scary situation, and I think ultimately players have to realize that, you know, they have to be responsible. You could hit, you could be rough, but there's a time where someone, you know, God forbid, is either going to get killed or they're going to have a spinal cord injury and be paralyzed. And I think that one of the first things that needs to happen is that when you hear a comment from a player who says, and it's usually a repeat offender, who says, well, I really didn't want to hurt him. That's bullshit. You wanted to hurt him. We've played sports. You're looking to hurt a player. You're looking to intimidate him. You're looking to stop him at times. But you can't be looking to kill him or paralyze him. And there's no differentiation there. And that's what needs to really happen. And, you know, whether it's equipment changes that needs to take place, I think there needs to be much more awareness of just how a player needs to be physically responsible for what he could do on the ice.
Yeah, and not to say that this has only happened with the Blackhawks, but, you know, and not to, we're not, you know, Dave Scatcherd said that, hey, you know, I mean, something is going on, and I think more, instead of, you know, having a you know, that NHL camp in Toronto, the research in the discovery phase of rule changes and stuff like that, why not look deeper into their own drug testing policy? Because there's something going on that these players who have concussions or get concussions, they want to be back in the lineup as soon as possible. And we already know that there's a lot of problems with the NHL's drug testing policy because, number one, some players are only tested once a year. They're not tested in training camp, and there is no testing in the postseason. Forget about off-season. They don't test in the postseason. So once the postseason starts, the players can do whatever they want without fear of being caught. And that's a big thing. And you know, talking about concussions, Brent Seabrook, last year after the hit from Rafi Torres, he gets hit, he gets sent to the quiet room for 15 minutes, he's in the quiet room, as soon as his 15 minutes are up, he's back on the bench. You know, I mean, the NHL needs to take a deeper look at that, and maybe there has to be, instead of being evaluated, to your point, like by a team doctor, that each NHL arena, perhaps, has to bring in an outside doctor, an independent doctor from the area who's there on site to take care of things like that, specifically a concussion, to evaluate that player instead of it being a team doctor who has an interest in the process. Not to say that the Blackhawks doctors have done anybody wrong. I don't know. But this is going on all over the league where guys get their bells rung, like pretty darn bad, like Seabrook did, and they come back out to play. And a lot of times, and almost in every case, it's the player just saying, no, I want to go back. But they don't, I mean, they really don't know. Do they have their best judgment in, you know, in their own brain at that point?
Yeah.
Probably not.
Well, you know what? It's And neither one of us are implying that there's wrongdoing by a doctor, because we don't know that to be the case. It just doesn't seem to be the proper format to ensure standards that are consistent. And when I was at that panel, on fitness panel at the convention, the doctor for the Hawks was there. And the one thing that he said struck him about hockey players more than any other sports or any other people that he's encountered is the fact that no matter how bad they're hurt, they always want to come back on the ice. So that is instilled in these men from the time that they're, you know, 10 years old. They're coming back on the ice. It's a badge of honor, whether, you know, their ears hanging off or whatever. They're coming back on the ice, and that's what they feel is expected. There's an allegiance to everyone else in that room that they're not going to let them down. So, you know, do they tell the truth when they're asked questions? You know, is there a gray area? You know, and then you have a doctor who's around these guys every day, has to be the bad guy. And that, in that case, the Hawks doctor took Seabrook off the bench after that Raffi Torres hit, if I remember correctly.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, he did. And I mean, but you're putting him in a tough spot too. It just seems to be that there would be a better way to do it. And in the NHL, they're trying to do things, but they always seem to get caught in between. You know, the area behind the net that you could run a player, especially a defenseman, and I call it the killing zone. It's ridiculous. Yeah, you want to instill that the game is rough. It's a contact sport. But if any spot on the ice where a player could get caught with his head down, a puck at his feet, is behind the net. But yet, there's no penalty for that. You know, they let that go. They let that slide. It doesn't make sense. So they're starting to move forward. Hopefully, before someone could get any more people get seriously injured, you know, we could try to get it as right as can be, but ultimately it's up to the players to realize that they have a huge responsibility to each other.
Okay, one more thing from the Toronto radio station, again, fan590.com. Mike Camilleri, another interview, same day, Thursday, August 25th, talking about players, and, you know, you talk about guys that will do anything that they have to get back out on the ice, talking about players and what he said, and I don't believe it's in this clip because I had to cut it down to 53 seconds, but what he says is an important topic, an important issue that he wants everybody to know about, you know, is what's going on in the NHL and players using uppers and downers. Take a listen.
So what ends up happening is that you know, after a game, you might not be able to get to sleep till 3-4 in the morning because you're all wound up. Then you got a meeting at 8:30 the next morning at the rink, and you got to get that sleep in because then you don't want to feel tired the next day, and then the vicious cycle continues. And what's taking place is guys have, because of that schedule that way, guys have taken, you know, either sleeping pills or things that are going to help them sleep, just some dangerous substances to come down at night. And then what ends up happening inevitably is they're somewhat drowsy before the game, so then they might take some artificial stimulant as an upper to get them up for the game. And then once again, here comes the cycle, and then it takes more and more to feel the way they want to feel. And it brings in a whole plethora of other psychological issues that can be created from this.
Wow. I mean, none of that is a surprise, but that a current NHL player would come out and say that on one of the biggest radio stations in the country and in North America is pretty eye opening. I want to make the point, and we got to move on, but I want to make the point. I'll give you a chance, Al. But while stimulants are, you know, the NHL uses the quote unquote out of competition banned substance list from the World Anti-Doping Agency. It's an old list, but stimulants are banned. So he didn't name it, you know, he didn't name any supplements, so we don't know. But he did say artificial. Artificial substances are banned. So you get back to player, you know, some players are tested once a year, some twice, some three times. And there's a real shady review process that includes, you know, a chance for players to get therapeutic use exemptions and a lot of stuff, and topic for another day. But amphetamines are on the banned substance list. Now, as far as downers, sleeping pills and agents like that, they are not. But the problem, and as Camilleri talks about, if you start to take those sleeping aids or anti-depression aids, it leads to the other end of it, and then you get caught in between, and you end up being, you know, kind of caught into, you know, wrapped up into both, and then that's where you get a lot of problems. And antidepressants should be on the banned substance list anyway, because what a lot of people don't know is that if you abuse those, that's where you get sent into depression. You know, if you overuse them, that's where you get sent into depression, loss of memory, and all sorts. So that should be on it anyway. But, Al, your thoughts on the Camilleri interview?
Well, just like you said, not a shock, very candid. What he points to is exactly accurate, I would think, and should be more eye-opening to most than it probably has been. At least I didn't read much about it up until you pointed it out to me and I listened to it, is that it just creates a cycle of dependency. And when you think about it, players playing a game, they get done. If they take a quick shower, don't have to hang around, they walk out of the United Center, let's just say at 11 o'clock at night. Now, they're not going home. They're going to go and get something to eat for the most part. So they get something to eat. So now you're there for another hour and a half, 2 hours. You know, you're 22, 23, 24, 25 years old, especially if you're not married. 1:30 in the morning, that's halftime. You're not even thinking about going to bed yet. And in many ways, you're still wound up and pumped up, and you just ate a big meal. So by the time they get home, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, 3:30. They get 6 hours of sleep. They have to get to the rink, let's say, at 10 o'clock or 10:30. When you're 21, 22, 23, you could do that, but and it could take an effect anyway. But after a while, the older you get, the tougher it is to maintain that consistency at a peak performance level. And Camilleri pointed that out in the interview more than once. You know, he's close to 30 now. There's people that are closer to 20 trying to take his job. So he's, because of his mentality, and I don't mean to single him out, although he was saying pretty much the same thing, because of the way these players are driven and they're, competitive, ultra-competitive and unbelievable athletes, they're going to do what they need to do to keep their spot on the roster. Plus, there's a huge amount of money at stake.
All right, we got a couple quick questions from the listeners to get through here, and we're going to take off for the night. First of all, this is from Mike. Hey, Chris, you've written a lot about Chris Campoli and said you agree with Stan Bowman letting him go. What would you pay Chris Campoli to play on this team? Al, what would you have paid Campoli?
I can answer that. I think somewhere in the area of $2 million, give or take 10%, but I don't think that was the ultimate factor necessarily. I think what happened was the Hawks, everyone has Nicoletti penciled in as a bottom six defender. I don't believe that. So, and I might be wrong, but if I'm not wrong, you know, he's going to play top 4 minutes, if not the first 2 or 3 months of the year, by the last 3 or 4 months of the year. And last year, he pretty much did that. And if that's the case, they do not want to spend $5 million on a third pairing in total. So they made a choice. Monador was a seasoned player who basically, you know, he's not the best fighter in the league, not the toughest guy, but he'll fight anyone. He plays with an edge. He could be the perfect swing man. He could play, you know, on certain nights he could play top two, top 3 minutes. And other nights he could play in the bottom six. He's a veteran, you know, and he gives them a lot of versatility. Once they made that decision, they decided better to go that route than to get into a battle with Campoli and his agent, and they weren't going to pay him probably over $2 million. You know, at some point, they have to fish or cut bait on these guys. It's the same way years ago with James Wisniewski. The Hawks did him a favor by letting him go when they did. They gave him an opportunity to play at another place and get top 4 minutes and earn a lot of money, which he hit the bell this summer and hit the long ball with a huge contract. So I think Monador is kind of in that same caught in between. Is he a four on a good team, or is he a third pairing defenseman? And I think one thing that has to be noted, and you know, these RFAs that go to arbitration, they have to understand unless the market is right for them, whatever that arbitrator says almost all the time, that's going to be their ceiling. They won't, if their original team walks away, which the Hawks did not pretend that they were going to even, you know, take a chance with anything. They were going to walk away. Whatever that is, $2.5 million, whatever it comes up, $2.75, whatever it is, they're not going to get that from another team. That's their ceiling. So really, they're almost at a point where they negotiate against themselves. The same thing happened to Ante Niemi. So Mondor is still unsigned. We'll have to see. Maybe he goes to he'll go to a much lesser team and maybe get his $2 million. But he was just caught in the switches, and the Hawks aren't going to pay a third-pairing duo. They're not going to pay him in excess of $5 million, and that's what it would have wound up being if Leddy is in the top four.
Yeah, and I think Leddy is going to be in the top four. I mean, the Blackhawks, we've kind of talked about this a bit, you know, since the end of last season and with the trading of Brian Campbell. I just don't see the Blackhawks changing their approach to the way they play the game. I think it's still speed from the back end, and I think they're going to roll with Leddy in that position. And, you know, maybe he doesn't start there, but Monador is a third pair guy. And, you know, this, I want to make this point too. I would have, you know, to answer the emailer's question, $2 million is where the highest I would have gone on Campoli at 1 year, and say, you know, help us win a Stanley Cup and then go out and get your payday in UFA. That's as far as I would have gone with Campoli. But I want to make this point. A lot of people are comparing the Campoli contract to the Lapisto contract. You can't do it. Lapisto will be lucky if he plays. If the Blackhawks are healthy, he'll be lucky if he plays half the games. So, you know, you can't compare those two. If you sign, whether it's for 175, speculating as to where Stan Bowman, you know, as high as he wanted to go, $2 million, or whether it's the 2.5 he got in arbitration, that's an everyday player. You know, that guy's going to play. If he's healthy, he's going to play 80 games. Whereas Lepesto is coming in, he's going to platoon with O'Donnell. So it's almost like you got to put those two guys' contracts together and then match them up against what, you know, Campoli would have got. And it's still less, because I think it's like 1.7, kind of in that neighborhood, as opposed to what we would have done, which is $2 million. Plus, you'd still need an extra body that's not John Scott. So, you know, I just want to point that out, because everybody's, you know, oh, they signed Lepesto for less, and that's a great move. Well, it's a depth move, but you can't compare the two contracts because they're not going to play the same amount of games.
No, and I think that, you know, unless there's a form reversal, which could happen in the second year, and Nick Leddy showed enough last year to be given prime minutes. You know, and I don't think this Duncan Keith-Nick Leddy combination is finished. And beyond that, I would think now the door is open for him to get some power play time, which seems to be where he's best suited in a lot of respects. So he's going to get the minutes. O'Donnell is $850. Monador, if he drops down to the third pairing, is $2.7. You know, that puts you in the $3.5-$3.6 million range for third pairing. That's different than $5 million. And nowadays, you know, $1 million here, $500,000 there, it does matter.
All right, one more, and then we're going to go. This question is about one of the worst trades in Blackhawks history. Hey, Block, what was the breaking point in the Ed Belfour contract negotiations in 1997? They broke down in 96, but he was traded in January of 97. I recall Jeff Hackett came in and took over nicely. Did the Hawks just go on the cheap so they're not paying an elite goaltender in his prime? And he also asked, did Jominic Hasek demand a trade, or was that another blunder? No, I'll answer that first. Hasek did do a play me or trade me demand on the Hawks, and Belfour was just their guy at the time. And Hasek didn't become the Hasek that everybody, you know, knows him as, you know, the Hall of Fame goaltender, until a couple years down the line. So the Blackhawks made the right decision in that point in time. But go ahead, Al, with the first question.
The last thing that you just mentioned, I can't blame the Blackhawks either for picking Ed Belfour over Dominic Hasek. That's number one. Number two, from what I recall, what I had heard, is Bill Wirtz was an extremely loyal man, to a fault. But one thing he didn't tolerate was any kind of blaspheming. So, if you came in and you talked bad about the organization, you stomped around, those players were gone, one way or the other. And I heard that it was bad enough with Belfour that they told him, get your stuff and get out, don't ever come back in the building. And as far as I don't know, maybe he's been back in the building since, but if he has, it hasn't been more than once or twice in all these years, because I can't remember, unless playing for another team. Whatever he did, whatever was said, he crossed the line in a big way. And at that point, loyalty for Bill Wirtz meant a lot, and whatever Red Belfour did, he did. And that was it. He wrote his own ticket out of Chicago.
Yeah, I mean, to kind of hit a couple of points. First of all, Hackett was playing very well. It was like one of those deals, like kind of where Antti Niemi was a couple of years ago. Every time he came in, it seemed like Hackett was having a great performance.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened at the time, Craig Hartsburg was the coach. So what happened was, eventually, Hackett was getting more and more starts. And if you know, Eddie Belfour, he was just a tremendous competitor. He was sort of an unruly, kind of a very to himself person. But he was an intense competitor, and that really rubbed him the wrong way. And not immediately, but shortly before he was traded, he had that infamous blow up with Jeff Hackett, where he pulled Jeff Hackett aside and basically dressed him down, which Belfour sort of denied. But something clearly happened between those two, where Belfour said, you know, I'm the number one guy, you don't go on the ice before I do, and all that kind of stuff. And I think that kind of led to what you were talking about. But the other problem with Belfour, and, you know, after Roenick left, you know, and the Roenick thing happened 5 months before Belfour. So, I mean, that's how quickly that whole team broke down. You know, Nichols and Murphy left that summer too. But the big thing there was, once Roenick was gone, Bill Wirtz set up an internal salary structure that declared that nobody was going to make more than his new franchise player, which he deemed to be Chris Chelios. So Chelios was making $3.5 million that year, or he just signed, I think maybe he just signed a deal for the 97-98 season. Maybe that's what it was. But he was going to make $3.5 million, and that was what Belfour was negotiating towards. And Wirtz said, no, you're not making more than Chelios. And Belfour was seeking $4 million a year. The other problem with that, and this is very important, Belfour had two contract negotiations with the Blackhawks before the one that led to his trade. In both, he had his agent was Ron Salser. Now, there was one that was kind of nasty, which was the one after the President's Trophy season, where Belfour wanted to be paid $1 million a year. He didn't get it. He got close to it. I think he got about $800,000 or in that range. But, I mean, he demanded, after being, you know, a goalie for a year and a half, basically, he was demanding, you know, top NHL dollar at the time, which for a goaltender was $1 million. And, you know, so fast forward. Now, you got to remember, while Belfour may have written his own ticket out of town, the writing was on the wall to begin with, because, one, the internal ceiling, and then, two, they waged, but Neil Abbott, who was the prime prognosticator in the whole Roenick, you know, unwinding, because back in those days, you could have an option year on your contract, which you don't have now. So Roenick had an expiring contract that had an option on it. So the Blackhawks and Neil Abbott waged a 2-year-long war, essentially, in the media and privately, on a new contract for Jeremy Roenick. Of course, they took their option year, so it went on another year. So Pulford gets out of this 2-year-long battle with Neil Abbott, and then he trades for Zhamnov. And you remember that those guys were traded; neither of them had a contract. So Zhamnov shows up, and now he wants a contract, because that's the reason why he's not in Phoenix anymore. Guess who's his agent? Ron Salser. Mm-hmm. Ron Salser immediately makes these ridiculous demands. That, I don't know if you remember this, Al, but Pulford went to the media and told, you know, I guess Zhamnov was asking for $4.5 million. He was asking for Roenick money, and there was no way he was going to get it. If the Blackhawks aren't going to give Roenick money, then why would they give Zhamnov? That's the reason why they traded him. So,
go ahead.
So Pulford goes in the media and says, if this is what he's asking for, he can go back to Russia. So that was a nasty negotiation that wasn't going to end anyway until Roenick signed, because that was going to set the bar for Zhamnov, which it did. Roenick signed in mid-October. 2 days later, Zhamnov had his contract. So Wirtz, you know, takes like 3 weeks off from negotiating with these agents. And part of the problem was he was the GM for 20 years, and I mean, even when Keenan was the GM, Pulford handled contract negotiations, so he had just had his fill. So now here comes Ed Belfour, who's upset because Craig Hartsburg, you know, is playing Hackett too much. He feels disrespected. He wants to be the richest paid goaltender in the league. And now Ron Salser is in the media saying that, you know, I mean, saying the Blackhawks aren't playing Belfour enough and, you know, making these demands. That was it. Pulford had had enough. And so a lot of information there, but that's the whole story, basically. It was Pulford just having enough of agents and players asking for all that money. And, I mean, I think even if all the stuff about Belfour was true, which it probably was, I think he was going to be gone anyway.
Well, I think the bottom line of it all is this, in that self-imposed salary cap hierarchy that Wirtz had, you're correct. But that goes back to Savard days when he was making $350,000 and was the top-paid player. The problem was they had as a group, maybe the Edmonton Oilers could match them or surpass them. At one point, as a group, the best goalie, the best center, and the best defenseman in hockey as a package. Maybe one other team was better. Roenick, Chelios, and Belfour. Within a few short years, they were all gone. It was when money was really starting to explode, and the Hawks never wanted to be at the forefront of paying anyone huge buku dollars. But what do? After all three leave town, and a lot of it had to do with money, Gilmore at $6 million at the end of his career. That, you know, that just shows you, you know, how when you're stuck in sand and stuck in cement, more or less, or quicksand, and finally you get loose and now you're in a panic, now you have to do something, you go and get a great player, Hall of Fame player, at the end of his career and pay him $6 million a year. And he comes under the pretense that Brett Hull was coming here too, which never happened. But it just shows you how, in a lot of ways, things were screwed up. And you mentioned his name a few times. Underneath it all was Bob Pulford. And when Rocky Wirtz took over, there was a reason why Bob Pulford wasn't allowed in the building anymore. So it's no coincidence.
Yeah, and the other part of that internal ceiling is, as great as Chris Chelios was, and he's one of the greatest defensemen of all time, you're sealing your internal salary structure, you know, and the guy at the top, as great as he is, doesn't score goals, and right. that's probably not the right philosophy, and for all of Belfour's demands, I mean, he wanted more than what Chelios was getting. Chelios was going to get, like I said, 3.5. Belfour was seeking 4 at the end of the day when he eventually signed with Dallas after that brief stay in San Jose, that netted the Blackhawks Michael Sikora, Ulf Dahlin, and Chris Terreri.
The worst part. They basically gave them all away.
Yeah. He got Belfour from Dallas, got three years and $10 million, so less than what Chelios was getting. So it was a mistake on everybody's part. Aside from in the end, Belfour got a Stanley Cup and the Hawks didn't. Under Pulford, anyway. So, any closing thoughts, Al?
No, I'm looking forward to training camp. I'm looking forward to watching the exhibition season to see how things are going to shake out and what they're going to do with some of these players. And we'll have to see. We'll be talking about Dan Carcillo for a while, I would imagine, and a few other guys. And should be an interesting year. And I'm hopefully, you know, they could stay healthy and start off on the right foot and have a very productive season. And we don't go down to the last game hoping for an act of God to make the playoffs.
That would be nice. All right, Al, hockeyindependent.com and also Sirius XM Radio. The Home Ice, right? Home Ice channel?
XM Home Ice, yeah.
XM Home Ice. So check them out there. I will be back next Tuesday night, the day after Labor Day, 8 p.m. Central, with the guys from the Fifth Feather. So blogtalkradio.com/thethirdmanin and also thethirdmanin.com. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll talk to you next week. Good night, everybody.